For those of you who have just joined us, or who missed the first session, let me back up with just a little bit of review. Corinth, a Greek city, located on the isthmus between the southern peninsula of Greece and the northern mainland, center of a trade, a center of military activity, a center of cultural activity, center for Greek culture, but is also a Roman city, since it was under the Roman Empire. The Greek culture centered, as often as it did in Greek cities, with there being various temples that were built. In the case of Corinth, there was a temple to the Greek goddess Aphrodite, which was a god of sexual prowess, located on a hill just above the city of Corinth, where it was manned by priests and priestesses. The whole concept of worship of Aphrodite was sacred prostitution. People would come and would enter into prostitution in the temple as an act of worship to the Greek goddess. Then at night, these more than 1,000 young women would... thanks, honey. Okay. More than 1,000 young women would find their way down into the city, where they would forget their priestess role and would simply become street girls to service the men who were coming in from all over the world. This was a great trade center. It was a huge seaport center. A lot of sailors and others who were coming in from the sailing ships from many sections of the world. So it was a cosmopolitan community as well as a community of carnality. In the midst of this, Paul comes on his missionary journey down through northern Greece from Athens down into Corinth, and there's a little church that is established. This church is made up of both Jews, because there was a large Jewish community in Corinth, and the Corinthians themselves, the Greeks. And so it's a mixed church of those who had some knowledge of the Jewish scriptures, and a large number, a growing number, of the local citizens of the Corinthians who made up the church. As a result, there were a lot of problems in the church, as you can well imagine. There's enough problems when you've got where everybody in the church grew up in Sunday school, came out of the church nursery, or belonged to the cradle role, and they all grew up knowing the Bible and having learned all their Bible lessons and memorized the scriptures. And even when you've got folks like that, why, there's a bundle of problems. But when you've got folks like this, the problems are just multiplied over and over and over again and grow much, much greater. And so these folks are struggling with all of the concepts that they've come from. Morality, ethics, lifestyle, all of these things are major problems in the Corinthian church. And when Paul visited there and established the church and got it going, then he left, and then he began to get word. People were writing him or making contact with him and saying, man, we've got these major problems that have come up in the church. There's problems with leadership. There's problems with theology. There's problems with the teaching. All kinds of problems. And people are split up into little groups in the church. Remember, they didn't have a building. They weren't meeting in a building like this. These are home churches. These are just people out in the society. But there's leadership within the church, and they're meeting in various homes throughout the city, or they may have occasionally have meetings when they all get together in the city. But they didn't have a church building. Church buildings were foreign to people of those days. They were just people who were living their lives and trying to be in submission and under authority. And so in chapter 5, Paul addresses a specific problem. that has come up. It's actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and of a kind that does not occur even among the pagans. A man has his father's wife, and you are proud. Shouldn't you rather have been filled with grief and have put out of your fellowship the man who did this? Now let's back up and take a look at the problem. The problem is, here is a man who has made a confession of faith, who has accepted the Lord, who is part of the church, who is living in the church, who is now living with his stepmother, his father's wife. Now, had it been his mother, the scriptures would have been specific with that, so it's very obvious that with the designation that is given here, is that he has, he's having an ongoing physical relationship with his stepmother. Now, we don't know whether this is whether his father is still alive or not. We don't know whether the man is married and has his own wife and is consorting with his stepmother on the side. There's a whole lot of things we don't know. We do know that this singular relationship, and an ongoing relationship, is taking place. And Paul is addressing this particular problem in the church, because obviously it's causing problems. But he says the major problem is not the fact that this strange kind of immorality is going on. The major problem is the reaction of the church to that. A major problem has to do with the fact that the church is kind of proud, that they have folks of all different kinds of morals who belong to this church. This is a fun church to belong to. We've just kind of brought the culture of the society into our church, and they haven't done anything about it. There does not seem to be any kind of discipline that is taking place, and so Paul is addressing the problem of church discipline here in the fifth chapter of 1 Corinthians. Now he says church discipline ought to start with grief. If you've got a situation that is taking place in the church that is sinful, that's immoral, that those who know about it should have a genuine grief experience. And the grief experience is because if you know about this, if you know that your brother or your sister is involved in some kind of action that is ungodly, you grieve for them. And the reason you grieve for them is because you know that God can't bless them as long as they're involved in that situation. So the grief is not for the sin as much as the grief is for the fact that you know that that individual is out of the blessing range of God. God says, I chastise those whom I love. Well, here's somebody that God loves who is due for chastisement. And you know that that's going to come. And so you grieve for that kind of person. But instead, he says, they weren't grieving. They were proud. They were kind of supporting the relationship. Everybody seems to know about it, and nobody's done anything about it. And Paul says, you should have put this person out of the fellowship. Now, we're going to discuss just a little bit later about what that means. Now, he says, even though I am not physically present, I am with you in spirit. He's writing, remember, he had said in the fourth chapter that he was writing to them as a father. And he says, this is a father writing back to his children. And I am with you in spirit, and I have already passed judgment on the one who did this. He says, I've already made up my mind as to what needs to be done in this situation, just as if I were present. When you're assembled in the name of our Lord Jesus, and I am with you in spirit, and the power of our Lord Jesus is present, hand this man over to Satan, so that the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved on the day of the Lord. Now that's the heart of everything he's saying about what should be done here in the midst of this. Hand this man over to Satan, so that the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved on the day of the Lord. The veiled reference that he is giving here is back to the book of Job. If you will remember the scenario that happened in Job, of where Satan spots Job, who is a good man, who is not involved in any kind of wrong lifestyle, but who is a good man, and he goes to God and he says, let me show you that Job will eventually turn on you. He will curse you and he will die. Let me have him for a while. And God allows that to take place simply because he wants Job to grow into a greater dimension of his spirit, and so he hands him over to Satan. He tells Satan, you can do with him what you will, but you can't kill him. You can't take his life, but you can make his life miserable if you want to. And then we'll see what kind of stuff Job is made out of. And so he does that, and we find out the stuff that Job. Finally, Job comes forth and says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And when he says that, then God turns the whole thing around and moves Satan out and moves back in, and not only brings healing to Job, but restores him in a way that was much greater than he was in the very beginning. Now, Paul is following that principle here as he writes to his friends in Corinth and says, hand this man over to Satan so the sinful nature may be destroyed. Now, the mind picture that we have on this is of a person. Picture yourself in the pioneer West, in the old West, where the settlers went out and they built forts to protect themselves from the hostile Indians who were around, because they would move into Indian territory, and since they were a minority, they would have to live inside of the compound, inside of the fort. And it was dangerous to get outside the fort. And the picture that is given here is to take a man who is disobedient, who is willfully disobedient, a man who is a man who refuses to come into submission, a man who is arrogant towards God, a man who says, I'm going to live my own way and still be a part of this fellowship at the same time, to take that person and to put him outside the fort. You open the gate, you push him out, you close the gate. Now, the purpose is not to expel him so that the body can be purified. There's no way you can purify the body. You can't do that, because everybody has elements in their life. We're talking about somebody who is in willful, disrupting disobedience in the church. And you put him outside the church, and the purpose for doing that is, once outside, the Indians are going to attack him. And he's going to be on the run. And when things get bad enough, he's going to come knocking at the door of the fort and is going to say, let me back in. At which time, those inside are going to say, are you going to do it God's way? And if he says yes, then you open the door and you welcome him back. But you leave him out there long enough until he gets a whole dose of what's going on. At which time, the suffering will return him to God. So that's what he's talking about here in the fifth verse. Hand this man over to Satan in order that, or so that, the sinful nature may be destroyed and his spirit saved on the day of the Lord. As I look at suffering in the Christian life, I am convinced that the major purpose of suffering is to turn us to God. God does not allow us to suffer for any other reason than that our hearts will turn to Him. The agony that we go through with pain, physical pain, and disease, and fears, and family situations, and job situations, that all of these things are to turn us to God. Announcement was made yesterday that Harris is getting ready to lay off 500 people. That's a frightening situation. We've got some folks in this church, some of you, who may get caught in that kind of thing. You're suddenly going to be without a job. And some who have worked for the company for a long time, and suddenly your income is cut off. And it's not that you're taking early retirement and you're going to have a nice retirement income. You're not going to have anything. Well, when you start asking why, The answer always comes back. It's not that you're a sinner necessarily, but the answer is that you will, so that you will turn to God, so that you will trust in Him, so that you will understand that your source is not the Harris Corporation or the United States government or whoever else you may be depending on. Your source is God. So the principle that is here is probably far more important than the whole concept of church discipline. Now, we could spend a long time talking about church discipline. I'm far more interested in the principle of that God uses Satan or allows Satan to get involved in our lives, in the life of a Christian, so that we will turn to God. And in the turning, be welcomed back in and, as he says here, saved on the day of the Lord. Now, let's go ahead with this, and then I want to pause for a minute and have some questions before we get into the next chapter. He says, your boasting is not good. And this has been one of the problems in the church, that there's been an acceptance of this kind of situation. Don't you know that little yeast works through the whole batch of dough? Get rid of the old yeast, that you may be a new batch without yeast, as you really are. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but with bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth. He's making a reference here to the matzah bread that was used for the Passover, which is a bread without yeast. And he says, when you come into the presence of God in the Eucharist, or using the Passover concept here, using the Passover bread, that bread was always without yeast. In fact, for a week prior to the Passover, the Jewish wife, and still today does this in the Orthodox Jewish home, goes through the home looking for any kind of fermentation that will be in the home. Anything that is fermented is swept out of the home. And there's ceremonies for this. There's a ritual to cleanse the house of anything that is fermented, anything that is rotten. And Paul is using this here. He says the whole thing, the same concept applies to the church itself, that the church should be the Passover bread. And if there's anything impure within the church, we should get rid of it, so that the bread that we have should not be bread with yeast, but bread without yeast, unleavened bread as such. And so he's using the picture story here. And he says in verse 9, I have written you in my letter not to associate with sexual immoral people. Not at all meaning the people of this world who are immoral, or the greedy, or the swindlers, or the idolaters. In that case, you'd have to leave this world. He's saying, especially if you live in Corinth, that you have no choice. Everybody you associate with is immoral. You do business with these people. You live next door to them. You buy your food from them. Everybody out there is... You can't live in a sterile society, and the church should not live in a sterile society, he said. The church is to be, and he uses another concept later on where he takes the opposite of this. He says the church is to be the leaven or the yeast in the society. We're to permeate that society. And so he says you can't do that. He said in that case you'd have to leave this world totally and completely, be in heaven. But now I'm writing you that you must not associate with anyone who calls himself a brother who is sexually immoral or greedy, an idolater or a slanderer or a drunkard or a swindler. With such a man, don't even eat. He says, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not, however, to judge those inside? God will judge those outside. And then he closes out by saying, expel the wicked man from among you. He's very specific in what he's saying should take place. Now, there's an interesting subchapter to this, appendix to this, over in the book of 2 Corinthians, the second chapter. And if you want to turn with me over there just very quickly. This is the second letter that Paul wrote to the church at Corinth. In 2 Corinthians 2. Beginning with verse 5, he is referring to this earlier instance that took place. He says, now get rid of this man, get him out of there. He says you submit him to discipline and you get him out of the church. Now look what he says in 2 Corinthians 2:5. If anyone has caused grief, he has not so much grieved me as he has grieved all of you to some extent, not to put it too severely. The punishment inflicted on him. Now, we recognize that the book of 2 Corinthians are particles of letters. I referred to that earlier in the earlier introduction. The 1 Corinthians is one letter, but 2 Corinthians is probably a compilation of at least two and maybe three letters, portions of which were lost. The parchments were lost or destroyed, and so we've only got portions of those, and they're put together in 2 Corinthians. So in verse 6, the punishment inflicted on him by the majority is sufficient for him. Who's he referring to? Who is the him? He's referring to the man that he was talking about in 1 Corinthians 5 when he said, put him out of the church. Now he's coming back and talking about him again. Punishment inflicted on him by the majority of the church is sufficient for him. And the guy has learned his lesson. Put him outside. He got shot at by the Indians. He's come back to the gate. He's back here scratching, saying, please let me back in. And now in verse 7 he says, now instead you ought to forgive and to comfort him, so that he will not be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. I urge you, therefore, to reaffirm your love for him. And then he goes on to talk a little bit about forgiveness. Now, that passage is a direct reference back to 1 Corinthians 5, and we cannot read 1 Corinthians 5 without reading 2 Corinthians 2 at the same time, because we need to understand that the purpose of all discipline is for restoration. If you don't enter into it for the purpose of restoration, it is simply vengeance. But if discipline is entered into for the purpose of restoration, then it has value and merit. Now, you know, would that all discipline were viewed that way. Would that our penal system in our secular society look upon it that way, that the purpose of putting people into prison is not just to punish them, but to restore them. We call them rehabilitative programs, but all of us know that that doesn't work very well. But the purpose should be for that. The purpose should never be for vengeance. The purpose of all punishment, if you punish your child, the purpose of punishing that child is to see him restored and brought back into an even better place. You don't spank a child simply because you're angry at him. You spank him because you want him to learn a lesson. And hopefully, if there's a little pain inflicted, he'll not do it again the second time. And so there needs to be a certain amount of chastisement that goes on with punishment for the purpose of restoration. Now he's saying the same thing should take place in the church. The church should be a restoring society. It should be a society that is based on restoring its own, not just getting rid of sinners out of the church. The first church that I was part of as a leader, as a pastor in South Carolina, we had a church constitution and bylaws, which we actually ran the church by. We don't have any here. We've got a constitution someplace, but I'm not even sure where it is. It's stuck in a file cabinet someplace. And we don't have any bylaws for the church. Bylaws are simply behavioral methods. But in that first church that I was part of, we had a whole set of bylaws, and every leader in the church had them. We made sure that every church member had them. And there was a huge section in there on church discipline, how to get rid of people that we don't want in the church. And we evoked that. Usually it was evoked against the pastor. I mean, usually that's the only place that we... Usually that was the only person. In fact, the only people we ever... In the 50-year history of that church, the only two people that had ever been kicked out were two of the pastors. But the section was in there just the same on church discipline. And we had more written about how to get rid of people than we did about how to get them in, because we were extremely interested in preserving our society and keeping our little church pure as such. Now, I have since found out that the Holy Spirit does a far better job at that than than leadership does. But there are times when there is a disruptive situation that occurs that is causing problems. There are times with that kind of disruptive situation that you need to take action. We've done that a couple of times here. It's been a very painful, very agonizing situation. We had some of you were here, we had a pastor on staff who deliberately broke open a home. He was counseling a couple in the church and had an affair with the woman that he was counseling. And they were having marital problems, and so he complicated the marital problems by getting involved with the woman. And it caused a lot of problems. The husband stepped forward and demanded a halt to this, and came to me, and I went to the pastor along with a couple of others of our pastors, and we faced him down on this, and he grew very arrogant about the whole thing, and said, "I'm not going to break this off. I don't care. This is something I want to do. I know it's not of God, but I'm going to do it anyway." We were all prepared at that time for restoration. We said, we can walk you through with this. You don't even need to leave. You don't need to give up your place of leadership. You need to give it up temporarily to get this matter settled. But we want you restored back into leadership and restored back into a place in this body. But in order to do that, there's certain things you've got to stop. And he said, "No, I'm not going to stop them." And so we had no choice, I had no choice, but to evoke this principle in 1 Corinthians 5 and to come back to the church. And I did this on a Sunday morning. I first got all the men together in the church, as many as I could, and explained what was going on. And then I came to the church on a Sunday morning and called the man by name and said, "You're not to associate with him. He has deliberately involved himself with this. It's been an arrogant situation. He's left his wife, who remained and has remained a very active and faithful part of this church. He sinned against his wife. He sinned against his family. He's made a decision that is devastating. The husband, who was of the woman he was involved with, it was already threatening a lawsuit against the church for alienation of affection, and had he gone through with it, could have won the case and caused untold damage to this body. I was personally afraid that he was going to shoot the other fellow, and that would have caused untold damage too. I mean, the newspapers would have loved that kind of thing all over the world. They would have loved it. And so I said, "Leave. You're not welcome here anymore, outside the fort." And I came to the people and I said, "Don't associate with him." And that was the most difficult thing I think I've ever done in the history of this church. It was to say to the people of this church, shun him. Leave him to his own devices. Let God deal with him. We have tried to deal with him, and had he responded at any place along the line, we would have been gentle in that, restorative. But he chose not to do it that way, and so we said, "He's out. Leave him alone. He's not welcome here. He comes into this building. We are glad that he comes. We want him to. We're not going to say you can't come in. Of course, we're not going to say that. Everybody is welcome here. But he's not part of this body, and he's not part of this leadership anymore." And I even went so far as to say to some of the men of the church, if he comes to you and says, "I want a job," don't give him one. He needs to understand what's happening in his life. And he divorced his wife. Great pain and agony. Married the other woman. It's interesting. He went to one of the Episcopal churches in this town and asked if they could use the Episcopal church for the wedding, for the second wedding. And the priest called me and said, "What's going on here?" And I said, "Let me just give it to you in a nutshell. You make up your own mind on this." And He said, even we Episcopalians can't tolerate that. And he went in St. John's Episcopal Church, Ned Bowersox, went in and stopped the wedding. It had already begun. And walked in and said, no, not in this church. You'll have to go someplace else. I have loved and respected Ned Bowersox ever since. That was a position he arrived at. I didn't tell him he had to do that. But he knows the principles that were involved in this kind of thing. And they went someplace else and had the wedding. Then that left us in a great dilemma. What do you do? What do you do when there's somebody you really love? What do you do with a child that has said, I'm going to rebel against father and mother. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to bring my drugs into the house. I'm going to bring my booze into the house. I'm going to do whatever I want to. This is my house, and I can do whatever I want to. And the father finally has to say to that child, you can't do it here. You can't come back into the house if you're going to come back in with that lifestyle. In this house, there are certain rules that you live by. I'm not going to allow you to come in here and tear the place all to pieces. What do? You put him out, but that doesn't do anything with the love you have for him and the pain that you feel and the grief that you have in that kind of situation. And so he was out, and I've agonized over it. Last New Year's, I got a letter from him. He's living in another city now. Just a straight little one-page letter saying, I was wrong. You were right. The church was right in what you did. I made a horrible mistake. I look back on it now and realize that I grieved God and I grieved God's people. Please forgive me. And I found myself in the position of 2 Corinthians 2, of saying, you're welcome back. Now, there's still all kinds of social problems that are involved. And he's living someplace else. And all I could write back and say, this is the first day of the rest of your life. And we start together with it. I'm your friend. Agony that's been caused, problems that have been caused. But God did his good work in his life and has restored him now as a man of God. Not nearly as effective as he was, but there's still restoration. I think the only thing that is the determining factor in 1 Corinthians 5 has to do with the disruption it was causing to the local body. That this was blatant and arrogant. Paul earlier on has pointed out there's all kinds of sin in the church in Corinth. And as we read on through this, when we get over into chapters 11 and 12, we find out that they were even getting drunk on the communion wine. Oh, well, that's pretty bad. I mean, you know, it's a bad situation that's going on here. But this is so blatant and so arrogant that they really had no choice except to act on it. And so that was the struggle I had with this situation that I've just brought up. We've got a lot of folks who are involved in all kinds of problems. Immorality, if they're not involved in it physically, they're involved in it mentally, emotionally. And we trust God to deal with those people. But if it becomes blatant and arrogant and is causing a huge disruption within the church, then you've got to act on that. And I think that's the difference here. You're right, though. Yeah, sin is sin. And we're all condemned if we begin to do that. And so this is not a matter of judging one and not judging the other. It's simply a matter of trying to hold peace within the body. And so he's saying here that what's happening in the church is it's not right for the whole church to be destroyed. It's the same kind of thing I mentioned of a child who comes into the home and says, I'm going to tear this place up. Well, you can't allow that. It's a ticklish situation. Yet at the same time, I'm so glad that Paul put it in here so that we begin to get the principle on which to work of how it's done. And none of us invoke it correctly. So if you've got somebody who's bringing drugs in and then begins to pass the drugs out to others who are in there, or maybe he's not passing them out, but is very blatantly involved with this. As you say, you give as much grace as you can, you give as much time as you can, you try to correct it, but if if somebody is obstinate and refuses to be corrected, you have no choice. I think the thing that Paul is talking about here is not so much that you have to put them out, as much as the purpose for putting them out. The purpose for putting them out is for restoration. And you keep close contact. You just don't throw somebody out and they're gone forever. But you continue to keep that contact going until you find out that there has been a change, and at which time you certainly welcome them back in for this. Good, Sandy. That's exactly what he is saying here. He's saying the world like this, we know the world's like this, and we don't judge the world. If there's some person out there who's living with his mother-in-law or his stepmother or involved in incest, that's their business. That's the world, and we know the world is like that. And we don't bring judgment on that. The only place that we have the right to do that is inside the body. And once they get back into the world, then you're right. Then we love them as we love everybody in the world. It's interesting that in many cases, that the world is harder on Christians than Christians are harder on themselves. And the reason for that is because we're not hard enough on ourselves. I am convinced that if the Christian church policed its own body, we would not be policed by the media or by the world or by the courts on the outside. If we took care of our own problems inside. Now, we took care of this problem. Had we not taken care of it, the one I mentioned here, we would have been caught up in the legal system of this community. There was a suit that would have been filed against us. Had I not sat down, and some of the elders of this church sat down with the husband who had been wronged and said to him, "We're going to work this thing through. We love you. If you sue us," as he was threatening to do, it's going to cause untold problems in the kingdom, and you're not going to get anything out of it except a lot of bad publicity. And so we worked through him in this to keep the courts out of it. But had we not policed it, had we been proud and arrogant and said, "We're just going to leave the thing alone," the courts would have stepped in. And I see God judging the church the same way he judges individuals. Whom I love, I chastise. And if you get out of my will, church, I'm gonna chastise you. And I, unto whom much is given, much is required. And much has been given to this church, and I knew that God was requiring much. Now, the whole concept of lawsuits, that's the next chapter, and we're going to get right into this. I want to talk about this a little bit. In that instance, I think I did everything that I could. I did enlist some others. And I was not the only one who was trying to speak into Jim Baker's life with that. There were others who were trying to, and we finally just all backed off and said, "It's going to have to release it. I can't do anything about it. The thing has gotten big. It's rolling like a snowball down the hill. I don't approve of what's happening." I never did quite say it the way Paul said it here to turn him over to Satan, but there was an element of that that was involved with that, of saying, "I'm just going to leave this alone. I can't do anything about it." And the court stepped in and did their work. I'm in correspondence with Jim Baker right now, and I'm scheduled to go up next month to see him in prison, which I think is the next step of restoration. There have been a few others who have stepped in who are trying to do this also. And now that he's out, now we treat him as one who has been chastised, who wants to get himself right with God. The word that I have heard from him is that his prison experience has been a very powerful kind of catharsis in his life. I think the sentence was unjust. But God is in charge of appeal courts and things like that too. So we step in and now we do the work of the restorer, which I think is the proper thing with all discipline. And you're having many reports of girls who are, girls in particular, but some of the men also, who find it much easier to find Jesus under the law than they do outside. Absolutely. Prison is a good place to meet Jesus. Yes. You meet a lot of other folks in prison, but you can also meet Jesus there too. Chapter 6, 1 Corinthians 6. it's interesting that he moves immediately from what he's just talked about into this. If any of you has a dispute with another, dare he take it before the ungodly for judgment instead of before the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if you're to judge the world, are you not competent to judge trivial cases? Do you not know that we will judge angels? How much more the things of this life? Therefore, if you have disputes about such matters, appoint as judges even men of little account in the church. I say this to shame you. Is it possible that there is nobody among you wise enough to judge a dispute among believers, but instead one brother goes to law against another, and this in front of unbelievers? The very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you have been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? Instead, you yourselves cheat and do wrong, and you do this to your own brothers. All right, let's pause there a second, because here's the basic principle how do you treat a brother? How do you treat one who is where there are disputes inside? Now, you see, it's written on top of 1 Corinthians 5, where he says you've got a major problem in the church that needs to be dealt with. Let the church deal with it. Don't wait for the world to step in. Don't wait for the media to judge you. Don't wait for the newspapers to pick it up or for some reporter to come in and nose around and find something that's wrong and report it to the world outside. Don't wait for some worldly law court to step in and bring judgment against you. Handle it yourselves. And of course, the basic principle that is given here is that brothers should not sue brothers. That inside the family of God, there's better ways to work this out. And arbitration is the best way. Now, we've even got some organizations. There's an organization here in town that some of our people are involved with called the Christian Conciliation Service, where it is set up that if there is a dispute between two Christians, that instead of bringing that thing to a court of law, that they will sit down with other Christians who will make the decision for them. And in the case of the Christian Conciliation Service, it's even a binding kind of thing. You sign a paper going in stating that whatever decision is made by these Christian brothers, that you will abide by that, whether you like it or not, that you will abide by it. And there's some of you here this morning who have got involved with that. Some of you haven't liked the decisions that were made. But it's better to do that than it is to go to a court of law. And of course, Paul lays down the other principle here that Jesus lays down. He's reflecting on that. He says it's better to be cheated and it's better to be wronged than it is to take your brother into a secular court and to sue him. And so that's the basic principle. Now, notice that he does not say anything about suits against non-Christians at all. He says, once you get out into the world, you use the world's systems. But inside the kingdom, you use the kingdom concepts that are going. So does that mean if you're sued by a non-Christian that you don't fight back? No, he's not talking about that at all. Does that mean that if you're doing business out in the world, in your business, and the whole world system is involved, that you don't enter into a lawsuit? No, he's not talking about that. Does that mean if somebody runs into your car and tears it all to pieces and then does not pay for it, that you should not allow your insurance company to bring suit against them? No, he's not talking about that. Unless that's a brother. Now, if my wife backs into your car out here and then kind of giggles and says, well, I'm sorry I tore your car all to pieces, but I'm a Christian, so see you later, alligator, and away she goes, what do you do with that situation? Well, you convene a group of Christians in the church. Hopefully you get her consent to say, we're going to find out who's wrong with this. And you deal with it that way inside the body without having to go into a secular court of law. Because Paul is saying that's a shameful way to do that. Now, we're going to move on into the last half of that, but I want to pause here again and get your reactions on this, because all kinds of questions come up on this. And there's all kinds of confusion that surrounds it too. I think that Paul quotes that principle right here. He says it's better to be cheated and it's better to be wronged than it is to take your brother to court. Jesus is talking about a basic principle, I think, when he's dealing, I think he's dealing with the world when he's dealing with that, because the the whole idea is if he wants you to walk with you 1 mile, walk with him two. Referred back to the whole Roman law at that particular time, that a Roman soldier could require a civilian to carry his pack for a mile. And he's saying if he requires that, then at the end of the mile, say, wouldn't you like for me to carry it a second mile? I'd be glad to help you. I'd be glad to serve you. And so that's the principle that's involved there. Jesus does not talk about courts of law, but he does say on several occasions in that we give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and when we're functioning in God's realm, we do it with God. And in some of his parables, he talks about people who have to go to courts of law. He says there's things that happen inside of that, and if you break the law, that there are penalties to be paid in the court. So I've kind of boiled this thing down to say that Christians, that the laws that apply to brothers are different from the laws that apply to those outside the brotherhood. I didn't fully answer your question because I think each one of them has to be individually dealt with. Oh, I think the whole thing, Karen, is a matter of attitude. Paul Harvey says we become a nation of sewers. We've got a whole mentality out here of a number of people to say, I'm going to sue you. I mean, doctors are scared to death by this kind of thing. And so their medical insurance has gone sky high, liability insurance, and as a result, they've passed that along to us in their bills because they're sued all the time. Doctors don't deliberately leave sponges and scalpels and things inside of you when they open you up. I mean, no doctor would do that deliberately, but occasionally that happens and that causes problems. And then there's folks who want to jump on them, and I think it's right for the doctor to pay for the second operation to go in there and get whatever he left behind. But then we want another $15 million compensation for that. So the whole idea of damages enters into this. There's proper compensation, but the problem is way beyond proper compensation. It has to do with damages, where we say, you owe me this. I went through a period of discomfort. Well, you don't say. I would have died without it anyway. But I went through a period of discomfort, and therefore I needed to be compensated. Those are things inside, when you're functioning inside the body, that the attitude is the most important thing. Now, I think our attitude, and I think that's what Jesus was referring to, towards all people, should be that we are here to serve. We're here to serve them. Does that mean that we allow ourselves just to get walked on all the time? No, it doesn't mean that. We stand up for the Lord, but we don't necessarily stand up for our rights. Well, I think it means exactly what we're talking about here. That's a Matthew 18 passage, that after you have gone through all of these steps of trying to restore and make things right, and if he still doesn't do it, he says, bring it to the church. Now, we need to understand that church in that sense had to do with the authorities, had to do with the leadership in the body. It did not have to do with an open body, but it had to do with the leadership. He says, then at that time, you involve those who have the right to pass judgment on a thing, and they will pass judgment on it. So you bring it back to those who are going to judge. Now, I think that would apply specifically to Christians who are in dispute with each other, that you bring it to the elders of the church, or you bring it to a conciliation service within the church that's been approved by the elders, of those who will sit down and pass judgment, who will make decisions on the basis of this. And that decision ought to be a binding decision. You're not just playing a game, but judgment is passed. It seems that Paul is saying that it's right to stand up for your rights inside the local body, but that should be handled among Christians. Now, if I've got a non-Christian or somebody who is outside the pale of this local body who sues me, I have a right to respond to that outside, to defend myself to that degree. Defense seems to be, it seems to be condoned by the body. The concept of attitude is what he's working at all the time. I had a fellow a couple of years ago who really got angry about something I'd written and was going to sue me for a lot of money. And I had to struggle with whether I should defend myself on the basis of this. And I determined, yeah, I should. That it was right to defend myself, because what he wanted to do was to take away my house and my income for the rest of my life and deprive my wife and my children and this kind of thing. And I have the right to stand up and say, no, I'm going to resist that. That's not right. I shouldn't just give that all away. But I had to deal, boy, did I have to deal with my attitudes in the middle of this. If somebody breaks into my house at night and says, I'm going to kill your wife, do I have the right to defend my house from an intruder? Yes, I think I do. But if my attitude is, I'm going to kill this person, then I have to examine that. Then I become a murderer in my heart. You say, well, would you shoot somebody who would break in? Yeah, probably. But I would not, I don't think, shoot to kill. I'd much rather shoot him in the leg than I would in the head. The problem is when you not only shoot him once, but then you shoot him six times and then reload your gun and shoot him again. Then that comes into a whole different category of this. I think defense is right inside of what God is talking about here. But the passages of Jesus cause me great problems, Bruce. I struggle with those, and I don't have full answers on them. Make friends quickly with your accuser while you're going to court, lest your accuser hands you over to the court and then you go to prison and can't get out. I think he is talking about the problem with the accuser, somebody from outside the church who comes against us. I think he is saying settle as quickly as you can. And I think that applies to every situation, inside the church and outside the church. Any settlement that you can arrive at is better. But if you're drug into the thing, you're drug into it. But he says Christians should never do that. Now, if a Christian brother drags you into court, you can't do anything about it, and then you treat him as a non-Christian. But hopefully, there will be enough influence and discipline inside the church to where there can be influence worked on both parties to keep that kind of thing from happening.